Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 431.EZ0902. Certificate number 23821. Euro Westerns. Robert, welcome to the Omnibus. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, John.
I'm so glad that you are wearing your NASA headset. Oh, and... And there's a NASA t-shirt, too?
This is the official Omnibus t-shirt that I got.
Look
so
at that.
One of them.
A trash panda. A washing bear. Well, good. So are you an Ohioan?
I am. I'll jog your memory a bit if you don't recall. But you and Ken did do a really nice episode that I suggested in which... I was very flattered because you spent a lot of the time talking about me. And it was called Mulberry Mania.
Yes.
And I did a write-up of mulberries and a few other things, which you guys talked about for in great detail. And I've told my wife that, you know, when I die, this should be the soundtrack of the wake. You know, put this podcast on when I die, because it was very flattering, and I really enjoyed listening to that episode.
Now, does your wife and does your family also listen to Omnibus with you, or is this a thing that you take out into the garage and listen to?
They have done, but maybe more unwillingly on car trips and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand. Well, so tell us what you do, Robert. What's your line?
I work in intellectual property law. I'm a patent attorney. So to become one of those, you got to pass two bar exams. You got to pass the patent bar, which is all about the federal law surrounding patents, and then a state bar to become an attorney. If you only pass the patent bar, then you're what's known as a patent agent, and I was that before I went to law school. And then if you don't pass the patent bar, then you're just a regular old attorney.
Right. Ugh.
Yeah.
But regular attorney.
What are you even doing with your life?
Yeah. How did you get introduced to the Omnibus? Can you walk us through your early experience?
I was a Jeopardy fan since like 1984. Probably watched Alex's very first shows.
Were you raised by your grandparents by any chance?
Well, you know, my grandma was more of a Wheel of Fortune person, but you know, Jeopardy was on right after in my market. And, we had a TV, it was a color TV, and, I was, you know, just turned 4 years old probably, or was about to turn four. And, you know, the lights and the sounds, it was all very super high tech. You're fascinating for a little kid who liked that kind of stuff. And, I was kind of drawn in by the board and the TV screens and the sound effects at first. And, you know, later, my mom, I would watch with her. And then, of course, they dropped the 5-day limit, and I sort of, you know, that got me back into the show, trying to see who was going to be the next person to do super well on the show. And somebody got a 7-day record, and I'm like, oh man, this is it. We're rolling now.
Yeah. So did you ever yourself want to be on Jeopardy? I mean,
all my life. Yeah.
That's how Ken decided to be on the show. He grew up watching it and he was like, this is the place for me, but you've never done it.
I did in fact, get the opportunity to go on the show. And,
tell us more.
In 2010, I, you know, did the audition and got the call and they called me up. There was a guy in the same group. You know, they tape in groups. It's like 10, 12 people that they put in a room. Sure. And there was a guy there who got a little curious about me, started asking me questions. His name was Vijay Balsi. And he went on a tear when they called him up. They never called me up the first day that I was there. I was sitting in the audience. I watched 5 shows get taped. They sent me home. And I spent up all night thinking, geez, how am I going to beat this guy, Vijay? He's incredible. You know, he's really great. I come back the next day. I think Vijay loses in his 5th game somewhere, one of the first tape games of the day. And then they call me up. And later I learned that I had actually, Vijay had known me from the official Jeopardy message board where I used a handle very similar to my name, Robert KS. So he figured it out and he knew who I was. And he told the contestant coordinator, Maggie Speak, I know this guy. I can't play against him. And and she was like, yeah, you're right. We'll just hold him off until you're done. So they did hold me off for a day. And later, he was super generous. He ended up getting picked to be in the Tournament of Champions. And he asked me to come be in his cheering section. He even paid my plane ticket out to go see the Tournament of Champions with him and his wife. And he ended up winning the tournament. It was really great.
And did you do well in your taping?
I won one game. So
there you go. You're a Jeopardy winner.
I'm a Jeopardy champion.
Yeah. How do you not put that like right at the top of your business card?
Well, it's on the bottom of my resume. There's okay. A line.
All right. Well, why don't you start us on your entry in the omnibus today,
John? Did you have any media that you kind of grew up with? Were any of it, do you recall any of it being Westerns? I mean, did you ever, you know, my mom, I asked her about this, and in her generation, she's a boomer, you know, you would play Cowboys and Indians, you would watch Hopalong Cassidy and things like that. Was any of that still percolating when you were a kid?
For sure. So Bonanza, of course, was always on television. Wild Wild West was on TV, and I enjoyed it. That was more exciting than Bonanza. But you always had some kind of Western. In the United States, there was always a Western playing on television somewhere. And then when The Unforgiven came out, it sparked a revival of, like, it was kind of like when Batman, The Dark Knight came out, and all of a sudden everybody's into comic books again because it's like, oh, we can be gritty. The Western kind of came back. I guess Lonesome Dove was a big media event where everybody was watching the same Western, and it was kind of a mini series. But yeah, Unforgiven brought back the like gnarly Western, or maybe, yeah, you know, put Westerns back in everybody's mind. But
yeah, it was, I think, a very niche genre of Western. It was sort of the gritty, I don't want to call it realism, but sort of, I think you used the word gritty, very gritty, very sort of enhanced violence. It definitely not your Hopalong Cassidy, your Singing Cowboy.
Oh, and you know, all of the Clint Eastwood movies, the spaghetti Westerns that had that kind of, they were, in their time, right, considered really gritty. They were violent, and he was an anti-hero. But those were a kind of Western that, like, certain people liked. They were a little bit like Godzilla movies. Like, some people my age were really into Godzilla movies or Planet of the Apes movies, but it wasn't, like, universal. And I feel like Clint Eastwood movies were like that.
Well, I went on Wikipedia and just to see what kind of Westerns there are, because I think that the genre did proliferate into many different niche areas. And the list that they have here includes some weird ones. You know, you got your epic Westerns, your musical Westerns, your singing cowboy Westerns, your spaghetti Westerns. But then we also have things like acid Western.
What?
Your meat pie Western, which I guess is an Australian Western. Your wuxia Western, which is a martial arts Western. I guess the kind of the Hong Kong wire foo kind of stuff. I don't know. Narco Western.
Well, I can see what a narco Western might be. So there, what you're saying is there are a lot of different genres of Western.
Ramen Western, science fiction Western, space Western. There's something called the Weird Western. To me, a lot of these are weird Westerns. Mm-hmm. And then the topic of today's show, the Euro Western. Kind of hard to define, but it's a Western, unlike the spaghetti Westerns, which I think were made for and targeted to an American market and European markets as well. But, you know, they featured an American star speaking English and were really targeted towards towards Americans. Euro Westerns, I think, is a genre unto itself, and it dates back to not just film, but way back to literary origins that was by and for Europeans, specifically Germans and people in the German periphery. You know, it takes things from American Westerns, but it's also, you know, in its own way, totally clueless because it's by people who had no real experience with Native Americans.
So my first time I went to Europe, it was in 1989, and I was hitchhiking. And at one point I was down in I was in Portugal, and I was meeting a guy in Amsterdam. And this is back, of course, before you could be in touch with people, right? And we had made an arrangement, something like, on July 20th, I'm going to meet you in Amsterdam. And I was in Portugal, and I was like, oh, you know, it's July 10th or whatever. I've got to get to Amsterdam to meet this guy. So I stuck on my thumb, and I spent this time, you know, zigzagging up. And I got to Belgium, and I don't know how I met this guy. He didn't give me a ride. I got dropped off somewhere, and this guy was there. He was about my age. And he said, hey, do you need a place to crash? This is how the world works. And I said, yeah, of course. I'd love to hang out. And I spent a couple of days. I was a little early in getting to Amsterdam, so I spent a couple of days with this guy. And he took me around Belgium and showed me all over. And one of the places we went was a, I guess you would describe it as kind of a Ren fair, except the Ren fair was American Western themed. And it was a big encampment, and there were teepees, big, you know, full-sized teepees. But it was also like a biker scene. So there were a lot of Harley people, but the Harleys were all sort of decorated with Native American iconography and Confederate and, you know, a real hodgepodge of like, and then there was a big bar in the center of it, and we went into the bar, and everybody was dressed like a cowboy, total cowboy bar. And there was a band on stage, and I'll never forget it. We walked in the door, and they were playing the Dukes of Hazzard theme. And everybody, you know, just some good old boys. Everybody's woohoo, you know, the whole thing. And the band all night long was just playing Waylon Jennings. And it was as an American, astonishing to me because it was such, like, they had everything just slightly wrong. Like, no, that's not, you would not put those two things together. You would never wear that with that. You would not, whatever, you know, like, you don't, ooh, that's not what we do. Like,
right.
There was just so much stuff. But what was really weird was it was so respectful. I mean, it was trying to be respectful. And I was lectured many times and have been over the years lectured many times by people in Europe about the noble Native American and the purity of the American West. So it almost felt like a kind of like a European cult.
This is incredible. You have somehow firsthand experienced all the things that we're going to get to today. Now, did you get the sense that, like, this bar, this was not like half Americans in there? That you were probably the only American in there, right?
Oh, we were in the middle of nowhere. It was not a tourist thing. There was not an American to be found. And in fact, I went up to the band after their set, because I'd been in Europe for a while and I was missing home, and there weren't that many Americans then there. I went up and I was like, "You guys are incredible. You know, that was amazing." And they're like, "Oh, sorry, no English, just small English." And I was like, "You were singing flawlessly in English." And they had learned all the songs phonetically. They had no.
And there is, and even to this day, a huge affinity in Europe, and particularly in those parts of Europe, for the sort of romanticized, I don't want to say lost concept of the American West, but a heavily romanticized concept of the American West that's passed through these European filters and inspires Europeans, or at least had, and you know, maybe that's waning. We'll talk about that. But you know, all over Europe, where you go, you will see Indian iconography, which is totally inexplicable. Oh, you know, what is all this doing here? I'm in Europe. That's my understanding, is that this is something that's sort of heavily ingrained in the culture, German culture especially. You will see farms on which buffalo are unironically being raised. You will see sort of tchotchkes and landmark kind of, you know, set up signs and posts and things that have, you know, sort of this, I think they call it a pan-Indianism, where it's just sort of a mishmash of all the stuff that you might associate with Native Americans, even though they might come from totally separate tribes, like, you know, totem poles and teepees and buffalo and all this stuff. And it's just sort of mashed together and they love it. However misguided, some might think this is, there's a deep sincerity in a lot of what they feel about this, like you mentioned. So I guess we're going to kind of dig back into the past and talk about how that came to be. Early notions of the American West in Europe, I think, came through America, especially with James Fenimore Cooper. He's credited as the inventor of the frontier literary genre. His novel Last of the Mohicans, which featured his serial protagonist Natty Bumppo, aka Leatherstocking, among other sobriquets. The Leatherstocking tales achieved wild popularity in Germany, and for decades Cooper was the most widely translated author. The Mohican chief Chingachgook is Natty Bumppo's lifelong friend and companion. Pretty much everything Cooper knew and wrote about Native Americans was taken from secondary sources. He didn't pal around with any Native Americans. He wasn't super close friends with any of them or anything. So he was just sort of reinterpreting, reimagining things that he had heard and read.
Was there something about it? Because I'm picturing the German of 1820, right? And Germany isn't even Germany in 1820, but there are Germans everywhere. Central Europe is overrun with them. And what is it? Is it the frontier, or as Ken would say, the frontier? What is the thing that resonates with them in a way that they can put themselves in the? Because as we know, the entire center of the United States was settled primarily by Germans and Dutch and Scandinavians, right? Like the American West, a little known story, an infrequently told version of that story, is that the cowboys were all Germans, right? Like there are a lot of them. Like when we talk about the colonization of the United States, there was a massive German component to that. And even still, like, German is the predominant second language spoken in places like the Nebraska, North Dakota, like all of those plain states.
Well, as you all know, I'm your little fashion friend, your little middle-aged fashion buddy. I like dressing up, and I like to encourage other people to dress up. I've been really impressed lately with the sort of factory-to-consumer model where producers are sort of, I mean, the classic cut out the middlemen, but really cut out the whole branding, the whole retail model, and just make the clothes and send it right to you. And we have a brand new advertiser, Quince, who has a whole like vast website of products, men's clothes, women's clothes, but also houseware and knitted goods, linens. I ordered some towels, some bath mats. They have this marvelous selection of Mongolian cashmere garments. And you can tell it's all like just marvelously designed. I'm really thrilled that they're advertising on Omnibus now. And I really do. I've had very good experiences with this factory to consumer model. I think you get a lot of value for your dollar. And in this case, you know, as we know, a lot of these factories are making luxury brands with one hand and producing other, you know, other garments at the exact same quality, but without the little pony or the little whatever on it. And it's nice. It's a good feeling, I think, when you load up your shopping cart and you have all this great stuff and it ends up not being anywhere close to what you would pay probably for even one garment at a comparable retailer. So, you know, if you want, which I know you do, premium fabrics, cool design, you kind of want one-stop shopping for all your essentials and, you know, housewares too, I recommend you go to Quince.com and just check out the goods on offer. It's an astonishing collection and kind of the type of place where you could buy anything and it would go with anything else there. You could construct an entire wardrobe from their website. So that's quince.com/omnibus. You'll get free shipping. You'll get 365-day return window. That's a full year to build out your wardrobe and learn to love it, or like fully get into your clothes, as I like to do. And I mean, get into them, right? Not just get into them, but get into them. And now it's available in Canada too, so our Canadian listeners can get in on it. Don't settle for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com, quince.com/omnibus. Free shipping, available in Canada, 365 days to decide, although I know you're going to love it all. quince.com/omnibus.
So what was it that rang their bell about The Last of the Mohicans?
It's tough for me to say. I think, you know, part of it is just the hunger for any kind of what they would consider exoticism. So tales of the New World would have been particularly enticing. Is Cooper really Western? Some of it later on, I think Leatherstocking goes out to the prairie. But, you know, otherwise, especially in Last of the Mohicans, he's hanging out in New York, right?
It's actually not far from you, right? It's like Niagara Falls.
It's way east of me, man. Right?
Oh, okay. All right.
So how west does that get? They would have, the Native Americans would have been, I think, a very, they would have been people that, you know, would have been unfamiliar. I don't want to use the word exotic. That's got sort of maybe perhaps some racist overtones, but,
well, but that would have been, I mean, the idea of the noble savage would have been very common in almost any European thinking at the time, as a sort of, I mean, this is Hobbes and Locke, right? You've got is man basically the urbanized and corrupt European archetype that we see in our courts and in our salons, or is man left to his own devices, this beautiful, pure, good, like you say, exotic other?
And speaking as a millennial in the 21st century, I can, you know, authoritatively state that yes, a German in 1820 would have been totally drawn to and identified with that kind of purity of spirit, something that they might have considered that they were losing in rapid industrialization. Maybe not in 1820, but you know, as the century went on.
Oh yeah, 1820 would have been already coal smoke filling the skies, right?
The first German to write literary texts about the United States, including the American West, was Charles Sealsfield, which was the nom de plume of a runaway monk from Austria named Karl Anton Postel. His writings generally had a political tone, setting up contrasts with the oppressive Austrian government. Some of his fiction writings depicted the Native American struggle for survival against U.S. expansion. So these themes are trickling in. From May to August 1854, Baldwin Mulhausen served as a topographer and draftsman for an expedition through the western United States to survey a route for a proposed transcontinental railway going from Arkansas to Southern California along the 35th parallel. A few years later, he was one of the first European explorers of the Colorado River and the Grand Canyon. 1857, 1858.
But he was working on behalf of American industrialists. He wasn't out there like surveying the West on behalf of Austria.
Right. When he came back, he wrote like 40 adventure novels and 80 novelettes plus travel narratives that were widely read and serialized in German magazines and book series. So, you know, you're starting to develop this whole genre. We'll just talk about one more guy here, Friedrich Gerstacker, who spent 6 years as a hunter and trapper in Indian Territory in 1837, 1843-ish. And he was also a hotel keeper in Louisiana before returning to Germany to find that he was already a famous writer because his mom had been publishing his diary to a periodical called The Rosen.
Why the hell hasn't my mom been publishing my diary?
Right.
I ask.
2 years later, he published his first adventure novel. And by the time he died in 1872, after quite a bit of world traveling, his works filled 44 volumes. The one who really hit it big, the hero of our story today, if you can call him that, was a guy by the name of Karl May, who was born to a poor family in Saxony in 1842. His dad was a weaver.
How do you spell his name?
Yeah, it's weird. It's pronounced My, and the last name is spelled M-A-Y. So like May, but I guess the German way of pronouncing it is My. He was the fifth of 14 kids, nine of whom died before reaching adulthood. He worked in a Skittle alley at age 14. What's a Skittle alley? Do you know that, John?
A Skittle alley? Well, I think you and your millennial friends would think of it as something a lot better and a lot more fun than it is.
But taste the rainbow.
It's like Skittles was a game. It was like some sort of like bowling.
Right, right.
Yeah, so it was like
he was working in the bowling alley, and so he got exposed to, you know, all the grown up speaking coarse language and stuff at a young age. In 1856, he commenced teacher training in Waldenburg. In Christmas of 1859, six candles belonging to the school were found in Karl May's possession.
Oh boy.
May was expelled.
Oh boy. Was it a frame up though, or was he guilty?
Stories differ, John. If you read his autobiography, he frames it as he had sort of an in-school job, like a, you know, that rotating job of the week for the students to scrape off the candlesticks and turn in the scrapings for tossing out. And his sister said, you know, hey, we're so poor. We have not even enough money to light our home this Christmas. So we're going to spend Christmas in the dark. Hey, those scrapings there. I mean, would anybody miss those? But I think the documentation says, no, it was six full whole candles.
Not quite the little matchstick girl story that he's trying to portray it.
Yeah. So who do you want to believe? You know, do you want to believe his accusers here, or do you want to believe him? But in any case, he gets expelled.
So the hero of our story is a candle thief, but okay.
March 1869, posed as a police lieutenant, would go around and say, hey, there's a lot of counterfeiting around here, and let me check out your dollars. And this one's counterfeit. I'm taking this with me.
Wow.
April 10th, 1869, again posed as a member of the secret police, kind of same scam. May 1869, collected into a child's pram, a lamp with a lampshade, spectacles in a case, two wallets with $2 inside, and other various little items, and took the whole lot in view of the neighbors to a hiding place in the woods. May 31st, 1869, took a restaurant set of billiard balls.
A lot of these crimes seem like they were kind of thought up by a 10-year-old.
June 1869, stole a horse, which he attempted to sell in the next village. Again, June 1869, pretended to be a courier of the lawyer Dr. Schaffroth from Dresden. Early July 1869, arrested hanging out in his hometown. Transported to a crime scene during a judicial investigation. He escaped and fled to Bohemia.
So Saxony is right next to Czechia, right? So Bohemia would have been right over the border of his. He would have known, you know, the region.
I think he's basically persuaded some woman who needed some company. Hey, I'm the writer Heichel from Dresden. I'm the natural son of the Prince von Waldenburg. Let me live with you for a while.
These are 10-year-olds' ideas of perfect crimes.
May 3rd, 1870, jailed in Waldheim, Saxony, assisted by a Catholic catechist. He was permitted to play the organ at Catholic Mass, despite being a Protestant. And within a year of being released in 1875, after all this time in prison, sort of scheming about how he was going to establish himself once he was released, he published his first work of literary fiction, and soon became an editor for periodical publications.
Now, isn't this true of a lot of sociopaths, that it ends up that they are enormously talented? I mean, he's obviously good enough to play the organ in a Catholic church. He's convincing all these people that he, or at least briefly, how charming do you have to be to convince someone that their money is counterfeit and they should give it to you? And now he's revealing himself to be a talented writer. And yet, this is the first sign we've seen of him going straight in his life.
Well, there are some theories that perhaps he had a dissociative identity disorder or multiple personality disorder, as I think it used to be known. Basically, all these different characters and things might have been actual real aspects of his personality that he might have transitioned into and out of. There's no, of course, these days, no firm proof one way or another. But it might explain a lot as to how he was able to sort of, you know, filter, process things that he had read or heard somehow and spin them up into these whole new universes, these whole new worlds that he would inhabit. As a freelance writer in 1878, he starts publishing these travel stories. Here's a word that I wasn't familiar with before. Maybe you would have heard it. Colportage? Does that mean anything to you?
Colportage.
So no. This was kind of the Netflix of its day. There weren't phones or direct marketing. These kind of door-to-door salesmen of literature, call porters, they'd knock on your door. and say, hey, you want to read this story? And they would kind of get you hooked. And they would come back to your house. You know, I don't know whether it was week after week or month after month, but these were serialized stories that right. would have been, you know, perhaps bundled into periodicals or maybe gathered into novels bound in book form. And if you wanted to read the next installment, you had to, you know, basically be the subscriber and get the next installment. And so they would kind of get you hooked that way. This was one of his major outlets for his writing. Another was Marian calendars, which were these religious almanacs that were spiced up with pop literature to boost sales and promote moral themes. These were, you know, they had all the feast days in them and stuff.
I'm big fans of their chicken pot pies.
Right. His adventures were set in locales that would have been exotic to German stories, set in the Middle East, had a hero known as Kara ben Nimzi, which translates to Carl, son of the Germans. Among other outlets, he published in a Catholic weekly called Household Treasure. And here's his big break. In 1892, the publication of the Household Treasure stories in book form, financial success, fame. He made enough money to buy a large house in Radebeul near Dresden.
Wow.
Which he named Villa Shatterhand, which is today the site of the Karl May Library.
So all of a sudden he's a serial writer and a success.
His most popular characters were the dynamic duo of Winnetou and Old Shatterhand. Winnetou is the son of the chief of the Mescalero Apache, who later becomes chief himself. Spoilers. Old Shatterhand, who despite the nickname is not old, is a strong and skilled German immigrant who finds himself in the American West, you mentioned earlier.
Does he have a shattered hand?
Well, he has a shatter hand. That is kind of his superpower. He gets that nickname by being by having this ability to knock out any opponent with one well-placed blow to the temple.
Ah, not a shattered hand, but a hand of shattering.
A hand of shattering. And so these characters feature in a number of stories and novels. They're narrated by the Old Shatterhand character. He's called Charlie. He calls himself Charlie in the few occasions where his name is mentioned.
So this would have been right. This is like late 19th century. Even in America, the Old West is seen as dying out. It's the last years of, you know, all the old cowboys are hanging up their spurs. And this would also have been a period in America where we were romanticizing the West. And it was a time whose likes we would never see again, right? And this is also what he's doing there.
Because it was something that we were quickly losing. When I say we, the world, not just the frontier, but you know, whole races of people. In a preface to I think the first book of the trilogy Winnetou that May wrote, he really laments the disappearance of the American Indian. He compares them to Turks. So the Ottoman Empire is dying out at the same time. And he sort of sets up this this analogy between these two sets of people. You know, I think a constant theme is this sorrow for the changes that are happening in America and across the world.
Well, the age of exploration is gone, too. There's no undiscovered place left. I mean, we think of that as being a really modern phenomenon, but in 1900, that would have felt, we have steamships that can cross the oceans. Where's left? What place is there left that you can just go be a wild man?
The Wild West. I mean, it's thought of in the movies and TV often as being a lawless place. So that gave space within the narrative for this character, Old Shatterhand, who He's really skilled and he's strong, but he lives by this moral code. He's always trying to make sure that he escalates the least amount possible, attempts to never take lethal actions. Mm-hmm. He's on the Native American side. So he arrives in the American West as a young, somewhat naive, yet highly capable German immigrant, and he gets a job as a surveyor for a railroad company planning to build a line across the American West.
But he's a champion of justice.
Yeah, because what he finds out is that this railroad line is actually going to end up going across Apache land, despite what he's trying to make sure doesn't happen.
So that narrative, the East Coast robber barons who are riding roughshod over not just the Native Americans, but also the small farmer and the prospector. I mean, that's like maybe one of the primary tropes of Old West film and literature. But that didn't come. That he didn't invent that. But it's interesting that that's like a primary theme.
I'm not an expert on Mai. I haven't celebrated his whole catalog, but I have read a little bit of his writing and watched some of the film adaptations, and it does seem to be as you said, sort of an assemblage, a pastiche of a lot of different things that. Seem to us to be tropes, but maybe actually Mai is sort of a source of these tropes. I'll give you an example. Old Shatterhand and Vinnetou become blood brothers in a ceremony, solidifying a lifelong bond between them. This is after Old Shatterhand saves Winnetou's life without revealing his identity to Winnetou, that it was him, Old Shatterhand, who saved him. It was dark, John. Look,
it was very dark. Sure. He came out, he shattered somebody, and then he was just like, oh, I found you here.
So Winnetou and the Apaches capture Old Shatterhand, make him go through these trials by combat, which Old Shatterhand passes. But the kicker is when Old Shatterhand says, look, it was me who saved your life back there. And so then, boom, blood brothers. Right. Now, when you think about blood brothers, what do you think about?
Well, you make a little cut in your thumb or across your palm and you shake hands, and then you're bound to one another for life, no matter how many furs you burgle.
But you do sort of associate them with Native Americans, Native American culture, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
But turns out, according to all the scholarship that I've looked at on this, not a single documented instance of actual performance of blood brotherhood ritual, of a blood brotherhood ritual in any indigenous American culture.
Wow, that came to us through the Germans.
There are references in the record of various other European, African, and Asian cultures having similar concepts, but they actually may all be only literary or fabrications of foreigners. It may be there's actually no such thing as a real blood brotherhood, except maybe something that evolved out of the literature. I'm not sure.
Man, I can't make sense of all the different hair loss treatments. It seems like almost the type of thing that was built to confuse people. Like a lot of things in medicine, they don't want to promise too much. They don't want to promise too little. You end up being completely baffled. And the last thing I'm looking forward to in my life is sitting in some doctor's waiting room at a hair loss treatment center trying to solve my middle-aged male pattern baldness, which is why I've been very grateful to have been introduced to Hims by former Omnibus co-host Ken Jennings, who I think you'll see when you watch him on the Jeopardy program, a full head of hair, I might add, that at the beginning of the pandemic was noticeably not so full. What's his secret? Well, it might be Hims. There are no hidden fees. There are no surprise costs. It's just real, personalized care on your schedule. You don't have to go out of your way. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Think of Hims as your digital front door that gets you back to your old self with simple 100% online access to trusted treatments for real health concerns, not just hair loss, all in one place. For personalized and affordable care for hair loss, erectile dysfunction, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/omnibus. That's H-I-M-S, hims.com/omnibus for your free online visit. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Man, I am tired of spending hundreds of dollars on crazy high wireless bills. I know they're full of bogus fees. I know all the free perks are just baloney. But what's a man to do? Well, I'll tell you. You can stop paying, or rather overpaying for wireless, just because that's how you've always done it, and go to mintmobile.com. Mint charges you $15 a month for a premium wireless plan that's going to be a lot better than the alternative. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you can bring your own phone number. I know we've all had our phone numbers now half of our lives. Bring your own phone number, activate it with an eSIM in minutes, and start saving immediately. No long-term contracts, no hassle. Finally, there's an option to ditch overpriced wireless. And here with Mint Mobile and OmnibusProject.com, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for only $15 a month. If you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/omnibus. That's mintmobile.com/omnibus. Make sure you put omnibus in there so Mint Mobile knows where you heard about Mint Mobile and their $15 a month premium wireless service. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for the first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees are extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
Mai, with these characters that he's developing, I mean, his popularity just explodes. Estimates of the number of books sold vary. Conservatively, 100 million books. 200 million, perhaps, if you count translations.
Wow.
If the accepted higher estimates are accurate, then Mai sold more books than Hermann Hesse, more books than Goethe, more books than Thomas Mann, Kafka, Schiller. The only competition he has among widely read Germans is Martin Luther for his translation of the Bible, Karl Marx because of the Communist Manifesto, or the Brothers Grimm, maybe.
Wow.
And you have to take into account that when we talk about Germans reading this stuff, it's not just what we consider modern day Germany as the state. This would have been like the German Empire. Right. So it would have included not only modern day Germany, but big parts of modern day Poland, chunks of modern day France, Denmark, Belgium, Czech Republic. Then there were ethnically German parts of Austria-Hungary. There was a great deal of German influence in modern day Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, not to mention colonial possessions in Africa, China, the Pacific. So his writing had sort of an expanded sphere of influence. It would have gotten around,
I guess.
And it's worth pointing out at this point that Karl May was like Cooper before him, making this stuff up. Right? He had never been to North America. He was too busy being in jail. Right? he had only books to draw from. And another big thing that was happening at the time was Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. So lots of Germans would have been exposed to Native Americans and the American West through these traveling shows, which were hugely, hugely popular in Europe at the time.
Buffalo Bill came with his cast and toured through Europe, as they had done in America.
Right. And they raked in the box office because everybody wanted to see this stuff. And they were received extremely respectfully. Again, going back to your experience at the bar, they were, I think, very, very sincere in their interest. And they really wanted to know about the American West and Native Americans in particular.
Over the years in Europe, like I said, I think at the beginning, there's been an element, late night conversations in bars, where European students were quick to kind of not just lecture me, but sort of harangue me about the American mistreatment of the Native American, the American kind of culpability in the crimes of the West, with this sort of like, I mean, they were at one level very earnest, but also like a strange thing to adopt as your cause, as like a European student, who's, you know, three drinks in and is like, you know what? It's like, of all the things that we could be talking about, or of all the things you could be lecturing me about, or I could be lecturing you about, like the Sioux, some German telling me about the Sioux nation, it has struck me repeatedly as a strange kind of stance that I've encountered a lot over there. People who have adopted the American Indian as the thing that they are righteous about, as a as somebody from the, you know, from Cologne.
Another factor that may have led to this popularity is just the sheer volume and interconnectedness of the Karl May literary universe. His collected works fill 70 volumes. They're full of characters that might have their own series of novels, but they'll also be name-dropped or pop up in another character's novels. Another factor, the lack of German cultural heroes. This is something that you guys talked about in King Under the Mountain episode. Other than, say, Frederick Barbarossa, the Germans didn't have a lot of strong, capable figures to idolize. Wagner is contemporaneous with May, and they're both kind of doing the same thing in a way. They're creating this panoply of idols, of heroes that Germans can look to for sort of a, maybe not just a mythos, but a moral guidance. And that leads into what I think is the biggest factor, which was the German youth movement of the 1890s. Urban industrialization was causing young Germans to yearn for the outdoors as a way to escape the materialistic, the authoritarian, the bourgeois. There was a revival of romanticism, seeing the outdoor life as a moral renewal, hiking, camping, singing folk songs.
Nudism, as we've discussed on the Omnibus.
This movement, it evolved to become known as the Wandervogel, and musical instruments were carried. A new counterculture greeting from Austria was popularized, the friendly Heil. Karl May's Western novels resonated with the emerging ethos, and the youth found identification with the Native American characters and May's emphasis on moral purity, peace, spiritualized idealism.
Right. This does feel very, very much like it, right? That these are somehow universal ideals, and they often get transferred to, this is the noble savage, right? The ideals are universal and idealized, but then you find someone to personify them. So it's either the American Indian, or it's some uncontacted people, or you try to do, it's the back to the land movement. You try to do it yourself to relieve yourself of all the corrupting influences of your phone and your television and end up back where you're just eating muesli with oat milk and, you know, generating solar power.
So it's offering this mythic imaginative escape, which the youth movement was seeking to live out. And I think these factors kept Mai's works relevant well into the early 20th century, maybe beyond. But there was maybe one more factor worth touching on, which is the kayfabe. Mai promoted his books by having himself photographed in character as Old Shatterhand and Kara Ben-Nimsi, who really are probably the same person. I mean, they're both kind of alter egos of the author himself. He commissioned reproductions of his character's special rifles described in his books. Whoa. He led tours of his home and replied to fan mail. In response to ever more fervent fan enthusiasm, Mai began to increasingly identify himself with the characters, eventually going so far as to claim that his stories were based on his real travels and experiences, and that he himself was Old Shatterhand. He commits to the bit.
Wow. And were people buying it? Did kids like follow him around?
His fan publication stated that he had a PhD and knew dozens of languages. He would commemorate the death day of Winnetou as if he were a real person.
Did he wear buckskin pants around?
In these pictures, he's got the buckskins. He's got the whole, you know, very inappropriate cultural appropriation thing going on. But does everybody buy it? No. He develops some critics, you might say enemies. And this is what leads to sort of what they call the Karl Mai problem, which is, how could such a fantastically popular and morally earnest author have a personal past that included criminal convictions, pseudonymous identities, fictionalized self-presentation? And what did that say about him and his work? These journalists, and in one case, an owner of a newspaper, in response to his representations to his fans, dredge up his early life, his prison terms, his fraud, his impersonation.
Two different vagrancy periods.
And Karl Mai doesn't like it. He thinks that they're going a bit too far and sues some of them for libel. He publishes, well, he calls it an autobiography. It's really sort of a screed, a case against his critics. And so Mai spends a lot of the rest of his life just sort of fighting for his reputation and inside the courts and within public opinion.
And how long does he live? Does he live to see World War One?
He does not. He dies in 1912 from what we understand now was probably a carcinoma, lung cancer that metastasizes and causes him all kinds of problems. In his older years, he refocused his literary output toward the allegorical, the philosophical, the mystical, some have said. He considered the question of mankind, super big into passivism and the raising of humans from evil to good. One of the audience members at this final lecture was a Nobel Peace Prize winner named Bertha von Suttner, who came to see him talk, and she was a huge fan of his. Of course, being such an influence over generations of German boys, he had a lot of people who were really into Karl Mai. The eccentric German Marxist philosopher Ernst Bloch, I'm sure you know about him, John.
I do.
Albert Einstein expressed profound admiration for Mai. He is reported to have said, "My whole adolescence stood under his sign. Indeed, even today, he has been dear to me in many a desperate hour."
Wow.
So, you know, one wonders what kind of influence Mai might have had on Einstein. Would we have the theory of relativity today if Einstein hadn't spent his youth or misspent his youth reading Mai?
Robert, that is a bold, bold assertion.
I'm going to get bolder here. You brought up World War One. I even wonder, you know, given the heroes, the mythos that Mai created for the German kids around the turn of the century, whether World War One would have even been as big as it became if he hadn't sort of created this this whole generation of kids who maybe, you know, felt like they should all be the hero, like old Shatterhand, and, you know, get out there on the front and perform these heroic acts.
I would love to see just some sort of reporting from the trenches where all these 18-year-old German soldiers had old Shatterhands, like, you know, like the little lightning bolt or whatever on their sleeve that represented this what would have been like a universal sort of baseball card for them.
According to a plausible but reasons to doubt it legend, another audience member at this last lecture was an unemployed painter.
Oh, it's an omnibus episode. It has to mention Adolf Hitler.
Kind of jumped the gun a little bit, John, but yeah.
Sorry.
In case you want to preserve the surprise for just a little bit
all
longer.
Right. Go ahead.
According to a plausible legend, but there are reasons to doubt it, another audience member at that last lecture in Vienna was an unemployed painter who would only have had to walk a few blocks from the hostel where he lived to the lecture hall to attend. Someone who had spent so much time consuming Mies novels by candlelight and moonlight in his youth that it had caused him to be held back in school. I know what you're thinking, John. This is another great Nobel Peace Prize laureate, someone who took to heart the pacifism theme of this lecture. But no, it's...
I'm going pins and needles. What Austrian, what failed Austrian painter could it possibly have been?
Okay, it's Hitler.
Oh, Hitler. Well, I mean, that really checks out, doesn't it? I mean, talking about all of the myth building and all of the sort of German hero like fetishizing.
In a February 1942 table talk, these were these shorthand transcriptions of Adolf Hitler's private conversations. He said, "I've just been reading a very fine article on Karl May. I found it delightful. It would be nice if his work were republished. I owe him my first notions of geography. And the fact that he opened my eyes on the world, I used to read him by candlelight or by moonlight with the help of a huge magnifying glass." In spring 1933, a Munich-based journalist named Oskar Achenbach toured the Berghof, Hitler's residence in the Bavarian Alps, and reported as follows in the Sonntag Morgenpost: "The bedroom of the Führer is of Spartan simplicity, brass bed, closet, toiletries, a few chairs. Those are all the furnishings. On a bookshelf are works of politics and diplomacy, a few brochures and books on the care of German shepherds. And then, pay attention, you German boys, then comes an entire row of books by Karl May, Winnetou, Old Shorthand, The Schutt, all our dear old friends." The Schutt was a villain in a novel. So, clearly, Hitler, you know, like many people of his generation, was raised on this literature. He even spent a lot of the time when he first became chancellor just vegging out and rereading all of Karl May's collected works. Albert Speer recounted in his Spandau diaries, "Hitler was wont to say that he had always been deeply impressed by the tactical finesse and circumspection that Karl May conferred upon his character Winnetou." And he would add that during his reading hours at night, when faced by a seemingly hopeless situation, he would still reach for those stories, and they gave him courage, like works of philosophy for others or the Bible for elderly people.
Wow. It's incredible to think that our fantasizing fur burglar is somehow at the core of Nazism.
Somehow, it sort of all ties together, I think. The youth movement, which Hitler later co-opted, the aspirations of a nationalism, a national unity, And the Nazis didn't like everything that Karl May wrote. All his later stuff, which was about pacifism, they were like, yeah, we're not going to print that anymore. But all the earlier stuff, like Hitler's reported to have sent hundreds of thousands of copies of May to his troops on the Russian front. He's sort of never really matured over the reading of his youth. That he's placed May on this level where it's still guiding him, even though really it's just, you know, kids' literature.
Louis L'Amour level cowboy paperbacks. Well, it does, I think, it does comport with what I already knew about Adolf Hitler, that he was not that sophisticated when you really scratch the surface.
He was not.
Well, it's a lot to unpack, isn't it? I mean, because he also influenced Einstein, and we're probably not going to say that May was at the heart of the atom bomb, because, right, this is the 19th and 20th century, like everybody touches everyone.
Everybody touches everyone. But you do have to wonder, like, how much influence did he really have? Without Karl May, would we have had two world wars quite as big as they were? In what ways would things have worked out differently if his inspiration hadn't been feeding into the culture? He never really makes any impact at all on America. I don't think most Americans would have heard of him. The one way you might have is in Inglourious Basterds. There's a reference in the scene where they're playing Guess Who I Am with the cards on their foreheads in the basement tavern. One of the cards, in fact, the first character to play the game, to guess who he is, the card on his head is Winnetou.
I feel like that, you know, some of these ideas of heroism and nobility and the last wild place of the American West, I think we do see those. I bet you if you went to Russia right now, there would be people in a cowboy bar somewhere. I bet you there are cowboy bars in Indonesia and cowboy bars in Mongolia. And a lot of it is not coming from what we think it is, which is our own self-mythologizing, but it's probably coming from one or two remove, a local writer or maybe a translation of May, where the American story is being, it's like a game of telephone.
It is.
And yet it's become part of global culture, right? And when we see it reflected back at us, we think we recognize it because it has the hats and the boots and the Native Americans. And we're like, oh, yeah, that's the American West. But we have no idea all the permutations it's been through on its way. Like that bar I went to where I was like, I mean, that's the same Confederate flag, but I do not think it means what you think it means.
And so at least this question, whether this whole sort of cosplay as Indianers and as they call them and cowboys, whether, you know, is this just sort of good, clean fun, cultural appropriation? I just want to mention a pair of 2018 documentaries, both directed by Native Americans to treat this subject. One is called Searching for Winnetou by the First Nations playwright Drew Hayden Taylor. He's a little bit conflicted because he thinks the hobbyists are essentially good people, if a little misguided. One of his interviewees is Red Haircrow, whose own documentary, Forget Winnetou, takes up the counterpoint. Quoting here from the website for that film, "The depth of fetishization and exotification that occurs results in the objectification, dehumanization, and erasure that's at the heart of so many issues, from daily discrimination to repatriation denials. Germany is a microcosm of serious issues in Western society, of increasingly blatant racism, xenophobia, and intolerance, strengthened by strategically omitted or whitewashed history involving people of color. Beliefs, attitudes, and practices that the hobbyists think are harmless are part of systematic racism that continues to oppress and divide."
Well, on that note, Robert, it's been great to have you on the Omnibus. Thank you so much for bringing the story of Mai and his works to us today. The Euro-Western is now a thing I'm going to incorporate into my thinking.
We gotta come up with some way to go out on a more positive note here.
All we can do is put it into the Omnibus and let the future do with it what it may. And that concludes Euro-Westerns, entry 431.EZ0902. Certificate number 23821 in the Omnibus. Futurelings, as you know, social media is an unholy trash fire and we disavow it. Yet we contribute to Facebook and Instagram at Omnibus Project. Fans of the show congregate on Reddit, Discord, Facebook, and elsewhere under the group sobriquet Futurelings, and you can find them threaded throughout the internet under that search term. Our address for email, which was a popular form of written electronic communication in your distant past, was and is theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Physical mail, postcards, packages, and talismans may be sent care of the Omnibus Project to 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166. Our show is listener supported, so please continue joining our Patreon community at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Membership in that community comes with a treasure trove of perks, including years of photos, show notes, outtakes, studio shots, and mail, as well as monthly addenda episodes featuring emeritus co-host Ken Jennings. And depending on the level of subscription, perks including executive and exclusive merch items and bonuses. All Patreon members get early access to weekly episodes on Tuesdays instead of Thursdays. Well worth the money. That's patreon.com/omnibusproject. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheers and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.